I think you're right. I think that we're very unclear right now in when it comes to a definition for the term influencer. I think that back when I first started out 20 years ago, it was so much simpler. You know, when we talked about an influencer, we were talking about someone who was a recognized authority in the field. We were talking about somebody who had either an amazing idea or someone who was able to break down an idea in such a way that they could take people on a journey and compel them to take action. That's what we meant by influencer, and that was the world that I worked in. And we would take a, you know, an incredible idea and an incredible human being, we would put them together, sometimes they arrived together, and then what we would do is we try and amplify those ideas at scale. Now, what has happened over the past, I'd say, 5 to 10 years, depending on how far back you're going to go, is that the word influencer just changed overnight, it felt like. You know, whereas before it meant authority, then it suddenly came to mean, you know, a teenager Instagramming their breakfast.
Welcome to the Redefining Sales podcast, where we reimagine and redefine sales in a digital world. In this new series, we have absolutely scoured the world to bring you only the best of the very best. We will be working with each of the thought leaders to unpack all of their years of experience, their pearls of wisdom, and nuggets of gold into bite-sized chunks that will enable you to redefine your sales. Welcome back to the Redefining Sales podcast. This week, we have the incredible Julie Masters. Julie is one of my favorite people of all time and probably the person that I quote the most in our office. Every time I'm around her, I walk away with inspiration, new ideas, and she just helps me elevate my thinking. Now, Julie is the CEO of Influence Nation. She has been specializing in working with thought leaders and industry experts on the art of influence for over 20 years. And I mean real influence, working with world-leading brands and CEOs to become a voice of authority in their space. Julie is going to talk to us about the human activation of brands. She's going to talk to us about how, at the moment when it is such a noisy world, how do you cut through the noise and how do you out-contribute? She's also going to talk to us about her golden rules for content and what rules she has before anything leaves her office. And so if you really want to understand the true meaning of influence and not some of the misunderstandings and how you can elevate your game, play a bigger game, then grab a pad and a pen, listen along to one of my favorite human beings that there is, the amazing Julie Masters. All right, welcome to the amazing and the incredible Julie Masters. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you for having me. It's always good to see you.
My favorite person to talk to. You are probably one of the most quoted people in our office of like some of the Julie-isms that come out of my mouth.
Well, that's it. I don't know. Is that an honor?
I'm not. It is.
That's what you're quoting, I think.
It is all good. I will share some of them later. So I actually want to dive straight into it because there is so much gold and wealth of knowledge in your brain that I want to tap into for our audience. But I want to dive into it and start actually with just setting that foundation of what to you is it to be influential? And what I mean by that is when you talk about influence, I feel it's one of those words that everyone has their own interpretation and everyone wants to suddenly talk about Kylie Jenner and Kim Kardashian, which is not typically what I'm talking about. So I really want to get it from you, get it from the horse's mouth. Can you define for us what you mean by influence?
I think you're right. I think that we're very unclear right now in when it comes to a definition for the term influencer. I think that back when I first started out 20 years ago, it was so much simpler. You know, when we talked about an influencer, we were talking about someone who was a recognized authority in the field. We were talking about somebody who had either an amazing idea or someone who was able to break down an idea in such a way that they could take people on a journey and compel them to take action. That's what we meant by influencer, and that was the world that I worked in. And we would take a, you know, an incredible idea and an incredible human being, we would put them together, sometimes they arrived together, and then what we would do is we try and amplify those ideas at scale. Now, what has happened over the past, I'd say, 5 to 10 years, depending on how far back you're going to go, is that the word influencer just changed overnight, it felt like. You know, whereas before it meant authority, then it suddenly came to mean, you know, a teenager Instagramming their breakfast, or, you know, there's the influential egg. I think you and I have talked about the influential egg before, the influential egg that was literally just a picture of an egg. And it got 53 million likes. I think it was Kylie Jenner actually had the previous record for the most amount of likes on a post, and was voted by Time magazine as one of the top 25 most influential people on the planet. And it was just a picture of an egg. And so I think that we are, and I could keep going here, you know, people who play zombie video games are suddenly on the front cover of Time magazine as the most influential people in the world. And so we've got this really interesting situation where our definition of the word influence has changed. And what that means is it's very hard, if you are genuinely looking to raise your authority in a field, to stand out as a trusted expert, to stand out as a leading authority, is very difficult to know what to do, because we don't even have an agreed definition of the word anymore. And that has come about because what we've seen is we call it the power pyramid. And you know, people have been talking about the power pyramid back in the 80s. It's not a new term. And the power pyramid basically looks like this. So if you think of a pyramid, I don't know if I can get my fingers to make a pyramid. This is as close as I'm going to get, I reckon. What the pyramid used to look like is at the top you would have the powers that be, the monarchy, the government. Underneath that you would have the military or the enforcers of the word of the power that be. Some people call them management. Underneath that you would have the media, which are the communicators of the words of the power that be. Some people call it marketing. And then underneath that is everybody else on the planet. And what we've seen with the rise of digital is this just completely turned upside down. And now anyone with an iPhone can start or stop a revolution in, you know, 24 hours or less. And we've seen it happen. We're seeing it happen more and more. You could have a YouTube channel in 5 minutes. You could start a blog in 10 minutes. And suddenly there are so many voices across so many platforms. And the world of influence has been turned on its head. So that's a very strange answer to your question that went all the way from zombies to revolutions to eggs.
Eggs, yeah. The egg one is the egg one is still my favorite every time. But that actually begs a really good question, which is, if you can start a YouTube channel in 5 minutes flat, you are competing with an egg. You are competing with everybody. You know, you've spent your whole entire career decoding influence. So how, when there is now so much noise, because we can all start a YouTube channel in 5 minutes, how do you stand out from that noise?
I mean, my particular area of expertise is in the human activation of brands and the human activation of ideas. And what we've seen is, which is in a way what I love about what has changed, is a lot of things I don't love about what has changed when it comes to the world of influence. But one of the things I do love about what has changed is we now, the most compelling thing on the planet when it comes to holding people's attention is human beings. We follow, you know, 96% of everything that we look at is unbranded. Everyone that we follow unbranded. And all that means is that we follow human beings. We don't follow brands. Pay attention to human beings, but pay attention to brands. We watch reality TV. Now we have Gogglebox where we're watching somebody watch TV. This is how much we love watching human beings and listening to human beings and real unfiltered, unvarnished human stories. And so the area that I work in is, as I said, the human activation of brands and the human activation of ideas. What does it take to get a great idea or a great brand and then activate it using a human being? And one of the primary things that it takes is this flip that I talk about from technician to translator. So we come from a world of the information age, where those who had the most information won. You'll remember, I don't know if you remember actually, I'm definitely older than you are, my parents spent money on the Encyclopedia Britannica.
Yeah.
And it was a lot of money and it was paid in installments. But the idea being that those who had access, it was pretty much, you know, as it was sold at the time, the majority of the knowledge of mankind, and those who had access to information were the ones who came out on top. We don't live in an information age anymore. You know, we have access to more than way too much information about every single topic now. So the age that we live in has now flipped into a translation age. And a translation age is the people that we follow, the people that we buy from, the ideas that we buy into, they are from the primary translators. And if you look at everybody you follow, where you read everything that they write, you watch everything that they do, you go to them as a source of information, I guarantee you it is because they translate something important for you. It could be parenting, it could be leadership, it could be business ownership, it could be podcasting. They are the people who have our attention, the translators. And the power of a translator is that you, translators, go out onto the fringes, to the places where I neither have the time, the experience, or the bandwidth to go. And they bring back information for us, and they bring it back and they define it down into bite-sized chunks using our language, and that's how they put it out into the world. And so what you'll find with translators, if you're looking at making that flip from being a technician into being a translator, is that translators are able to go, look, you don't need to worry about all of that. You don't need to worry about the 1,000 things out there. Here are the top 3 things that you need to know. You know, if you like my style and what I do, I'm going to bring back all this information for you. I'm going to translate it into a way that it is the bottom line. I call it the beautiful bottom line, the beautiful bottom line of what you need to know. And the people that I follow are the people who are able to do the beautiful bottom line for me. And they do it with a style and using a language that I resonate with, that matches my style. So, yeah, we're seeing this flip from technicians into translators. And the only other thing that I would say about being a translator is that it requires becoming fluent in the questions and the language of your target market. And every target market has what is known as charismatic language. And charismatic language is the language that we use to describe things when we're alone, when we're talking with our peers. You know, we don't use technical jargon to talk about things when we're discussing it, you know. And yet what most of us do when we're talking about what we do for a living is we hide behind technical language. We hide behind our own language. We're so used to our own language, we don't hear it anymore. It just becomes white noise. So the first step to being a translator is to get fluent in what are the core questions of your target market and starting to learn their language, get fluent in their language.
I want to tap into several of those. I've actually just made a list. So I'll
have a drink.
You have a drink and get ready for my list.
Go.
Okay, the first one I want to tap into is what you talked around, the human activation of brands, and that 6% of what we're consuming is actually from people and not brands. What does that mean for corporates? Because a lot of our clients, a lot of our audience fit in the corporate space. So how are you seeing corporates apply that?
In lots of really interesting ways. What I'm seeing is two parts to that. One is corporate starting to embrace what I would call epic storytelling. And epic storytelling is grippingly human. It involves human beings. You know, we don't really want to hear a story about a brand. I mean, I don't know if you've come across, there's this incredible brand of wines out of the USA. I wish I could think of the name right now. Something Thieves. And anyway, they've got a barcode on the packaging of the wine itself. And when you hold your phone up, what happens is the label of the wine starts talking. And it focuses on a particular criminal. So it's called Thieves Wine. And the criminal on the label starts talking and telling their story, how they ended up there, what happened. You know, that is grippingly human storytelling. And so looking for ways to involve more gripping human storytelling, we call it the Netflix effect, which is a term that I actually got from Ben Jones from Google's Unskippable Labs, which is well worth anyone that's watching checking them out. Basically, Google's Unskippable Labs takes, I think it's 5 billion hours that gets uploaded to YouTube every single day of videos. And they take all of those videos and they run experiments to see if they can figure out what makes an unskippable story. So, you know, that skip button down the bottom right-hand corner that we press when an ad comes on, what makes us not press skip? What makes us watch a story all the way to the end? And they've run some amazing experiments, but one of the things they talk about is the Netflix effect. And the Netflix effect is essentially the impact on our attention spans of streaming services like Netflix, like Stan, like Amazon Prime, where we are so educated now to expect a certain level of storytelling that we won't accept anything less. You know, we watch such incredible stories. I mean, how many things did you binge watch while you were in lockdown? You know, we're so used to it. And what that's done is it's created a fragmentation of our attention. So on the one hand, our attention spans are lower than they have ever been. You know, there's that age-old saying of they're less than a it's 8 seconds, which is less than a goldfish. Although I said that at a presentation recently, and somebody sent me an email afterwards going, "Can you actually back that up with any science?" I remember back and I was like, "No, I'm going to stop saying it. Can you test a goldfish? Is that a thing? Can you test a goldfish?" Anyway, I'm not advocating testing anything on goldfish. So, but our attention spans are small. Let's put it that way. But what we're seeing with this fragmentation of attention is that our attention spans are lower than they have ever been. However, if you can get us quickly by telling a compelling enough story quickly, then we will give you unlimited amounts of our attention. We'll listen to 3-hour-long podcasts. We'll binge watch Game of Thrones for 48 hours. So the premises of this, you have to get us fast. You have to get us fast. And if you can do that, then we will follow you along the journey and we'll give you unlimited amounts of our attention. To flip back to your question a second about what different corporates are doing, it's fascinating to watch at the moment. And Macy's is a great one. And what Macy's have done is they were struggling, and a lot of brands are in a similar position where they're like, it's just not working anymore. You know, the traditional advertising, I call it out interrupting, the whole premise of I just interrupt you enough times, you will eventually buy from me. You know, that's just not working anymore, or not to the degree that it used to work. And also the perfection of brands, you know, these perfectly curated, perfect messages with perfect brands and perfect looking celebrities, just not going to cut through that they used to get. And so Macy's decided to try something different. They said, you know, we've got all these incredible people, young people who work within our brand who are so passionate about fashion. And they have huge networks. The stats are that the average person who works within a brand has a network that is 600 times larger than the network of the brand itself. So that is if you just look at that purely from an ROI perspective, that is a huge untapped market there. And if we can't tell compelling enough stories that the people who, you know, work within our walls want to share them, then what are we doing? So they went out to those individuals and they called it the Macy's Style Crew. And they said, if we elevate you, we'll give you a platform. We'll give you permission. You just do what you love. Talk about what you love to the people that you love to talk to about it. And this thing just went off. Macy's Style Crew went off. I think I can't remember how many there are in it. That started at 20. I think it was up to 400 the last time I checked how many members they have in it. Now they're incentivizing with commissions, just completely redesigning the model. But what that shows you is that if you can tap into the characters that work within your walls, the characters within the brand itself, IBM did a great one back in, I think it was 2016, called Smarter Planet, another example of tapping into the passion and the characters within your walls. That's human storytelling. And that's what captures our attention.
They did that when I was there. I think it was something to do with me. Yeah.
I can no, it see you it was having nothing. A pivotal in that one.
It was nothing to do with me. And so I want to – so there's a couple of things. My list is getting longer. This is crazy. So I want to keep going through, though, a couple key points that you've referenced. So one that you've referenced several times is around epic storytelling and around how it's grippingly human. And I love just the language that you use around that. It's just amazing. What there's so much out there around what it takes to tell a compelling story, what it takes to tell a good story, what are the components and so on. What do you think the non-negotiables are in an epic story?
It's a good question. You know, I think, again, my background started in the speaking industry and, you know, working with speakers. And, you know, if you want to learn about storytelling, stand yourself up in front of 1,000 people and tell a story and see what happens. That's putting your feet firmly in the fire of storytelling, of human storytelling. And what we learnt and noticed when it came to what made an epic story, and, you know, TED has really done a great job of codifying this as well, is that epic stories are, first of all, they are relevant. So they're relevant, and we miss this so much when it comes to how we tell stories as brands. So I have the rule, and, you know, I've talked about it many times before, the keep it or share it rule. And the keep it or share it rule is essentially either whatever leaves my office is either valuable enough for somebody to keep it, refer back to it again later, or share it with somebody else that they know. Otherwise, it doesn't leave the building. And that's just my minimal rule for what we stand for in terms of storytelling. Because if it's not interesting enough for someone to keep and it's not interesting enough for someone to share, then why are we sending it? And I think we lose, we lose. And again, we've talked before about the vanilla ice cream problem. And, you know, the vanilla ice cream problem being that we, if we just use the metaphor of ice cream, we love funky flavors of ice cream, right? I love pretzels smashed in with fudge, smashed in with caramel, smashed in with hundreds and thousands, and just keep smashing stuff. We love funky ice cream. But for some reason, and it's the same when it comes to what we consume as messages and stories, we love diversity. We love real and gripping storytelling. We love not that, you know, not massively produced. We love behind the scenes. We love, look at all the things that we love. And yet for some reason, when we come to create it, we assume that what everybody else loves is vanilla.
Mm.
We assume that what everybody else loves is highly polished, highly branded, can't be faulted, technical language, no personality, not a trace of human in there. You know, so we get caught in this vanilla ice cream problem of storytelling. I forgot where I even started now. What was the question?
Non-negotiables of epic storytelling.
Non-negotiables. Okay, so we've talked about making it relevant. Is it relevant? The second one is it personal? Do I believe you? That's the essence of is it personal. Do I believe you? Have you walked this road before, or have you held the hand of somebody else who has walked this road before? And that makes a story epic. And again, when we're working with corporations or working with individuals, that's what we're looking for. We're looking for the anchor story. It's a story that someone can really feel when you tell it because you were there or you watched somebody else go through it. Another language for that is situational storytelling. So it's a situation you've been in or a situation that you've helped somebody else get out of. That's epic storytelling. And the third one is it emotive? And by emotive, I don't mean is it emotional? I don't mean, because when we look at emotive storytelling, you know, fear is emotive. Fear, drama, and outrage, the three words that rule most of the storytelling that's happening in the media right now, you know, they're all emotive languages. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking, again, about charismatic language. I'm talking about language that elicits emotional response from me. I'm talking about using my language as opposed to yours. You know, if I were to put a presentation together or put an event together or a trends report together and I were to call it, you know, the three trends in data reporting for the IT industry in 2022. You know, there's a few people who might pick that up who are just really deadly serious about the topic. However, you know, if we called it, and this isn't exactly right, but if we called it, you know, how you're gonna dominating in data reporting 2022. You know, that dominate is an emotive word. And again, this is where charismatic language gets interesting, because there's certain industries where that word works really well. I wouldn't use that language if I was talking to a group of nurses, for example, or people who are in a caring profession where that's not an appropriate word, and it's a word that elicits a negative emotion. So again, getting fluent in the charismatic language of the people you're trying to reach.
And I love so many aspects, but tapping on a couple, I love the keep it or share it rule. And that's actually one that after we heard Julie speak for the first time, because I've heard you speak so many times and just can't get enough. But that was something we actually applied in our office and said, you know, if we work on our own work or a client project, is it a keep it or a share it? And it was I've found in the business, it's been a really good filter that when we're up against a client deadline, and it's like, go, 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 they want it tomorrow. It's a brilliant filter to go, but is it a keep it or a share it? And go, yeah. Oh, are we just doing it because we need to get it out the door and we need to hit a deadline, or are we doing it because we can just keep it or share it?
It's a tough barometer, that one. And that's what I love about it. It's a tough barometer because you're really holding yourself accountable with what you're about to interrupt people with. And there's this beautiful languaging. It's a real estate agent out of Perth. Her name's Gia Lee. And she was struggling to make it as a real estate agent, and she was doing all the normal things, you know, interrupting people as many times possible, phone calls, door knocks, putting direct mail in their letterbox, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And she wasn't getting anywhere close to where she wanted to be. And she took a step back and she said, you know what? I'm going to take a different tactic. What if I stopped interrupting what everybody was interested in? And what if I could become what they were interested in? And she put together a podcast interviewing all the different people in the area about what it was like to live there, prominent business people, prominent restaurant owners, what it was like to live there, their favorite places, was the best place to go for a steak, their childhood memories. And guess what happened then? They shared it amongst their networks because they had a chance to tell beautiful stories about something that they loved. And the flow, we call it the halo effect of that, was incredible. And just to flip that again into the space that I know that you're prominent in, the tech industry, I was talking to a tech CEO not so long ago, and he said, the game changed for me when I stopped asking the question, how can I sell more? And I started asking the question, what if I could curate, design, and create a sales process that was so valuable that somebody would pay to be a part of it? And that's the flip, right? Not how do I get money out of people by interrupting them, but how do I curate, design, and create something that is so valuable that people would pay to be a part of it? And I think, yeah, that's the keep it or share it rule in action.
Mm. And the other thing I want to tap into on that is you've talked a few times about questions and really speaking the language of your audience. And we did an experiment with this after hearing you talk about keeping a question bank. So I don't want to ruin the punchline on it, but can you talk to us about the concept of a question bank?
And I feel I'm about to get sideswiped now. I'm going to tell you about it, and then you're going to say, actually, we tried it. Like,
it was terrible. It was terrible. Don't even remember. I just wanted to do it for my own entertainment.
Terrible idea. Talk a lot about keeping, which is what I believe you're referring to there, a relentless question radar. And it is something that I have done through my whole career. And it's something that I recommend to other people, and other people have put it into play with incredible results. And that it's very simple, as all the best, you know, strategies are, just to keep a note on your phone, anywhere, an Excel spreadsheet. And every time you get asked a question by a potential client, by a current client, write it down. Write down the question. Keep a radar of all the questions that you get asked, and then answer them. And have it be the design of your sales pitches. I mean, that's how we use it. We use it to design sales pitches. We use it to design content. We use it to design how to close. We use it to design presentations. We use this bank of questions as a foundation for all things. And having this relentless question radar also has this really interesting flow-on effect that I've discovered since, you know, being out there and talking about it. And that is that you get to practice answering them. You know, if you sit down and once a month with your team, make a time and go, right, let's kick into the question bank here. Here's a question. Right, Sam, go. What's your answer? And then I get to sit there as somebody new and go, oh my God, that was the best answer to that ever. I'm writing that down. And you're like, oh, do you know what? I'm really good up until this point, but whenever I answer it, I feel like I lose it here. And you had this great line. Write it down. It becomes this incredible tool for sharpening your sword as a team and making use of the collective brilliance that's within your walls. Not only that, but you can then take those questions and you can go out to what we call non-competing independents, which is just I need to find a better word for it, collaborators. It's basically people in the supply chain that are either before or after you. So they're not competing with you, but they provide a complimentary service to what you do and they have the eyes and ears of your target market. You go out to them and you say, look, I've got this list of questions that my target market are asking about this journey that we're trying to take them on. This particular question here, we're not best positioned to ask. Answer. Could you answer it? And then you collaborate. You might put a white paper together and bring in a whole bunch of different people. You might get them to write an article. You might, you know, interview them for a podcast. And then again, guess what? They've just created something amazing with you and they're going to share it. They're going to share it with other people who could be your potential target market. So many things flow on from having a clear understanding and a relentless radar for questions. The final thing I will say about questions, which is something I'm in the middle of researching right now, actually, is that the prominence of voice search or the exponential growth of voice search. I mean, it was predicted that by 2020, 50% of all search would be voice. I think at the moment it's around that figure. I'm trying to find figures for it at the moment as part of my research. But needless to say, it is the most booming area of search that there is right now. And what happens when we use our voice to search, when we use Siri, when we use Google Home, when we use Alexa, what happens is we search using questions. We search using questions. It completely changes our behavior when it comes to search. We rarely search using questions when we're just typing into Google, but when we use our voice, we ask questions. And what that means is that those companies, those advisors that understand the questions of their target market and the exact language that they are using and own the answers, they are the ones that are going to dominate search in the future. So again, we have all of this flow-on effect from just getting really serious about understanding the questions of your target market.
I love that. And we did it. I'll tell the story really quick.
Yeah,
we
tell the story. I don't think I've heard the story.
We did it as an experiment. So we heard Julie talk about this and we went, brilliant, right? As a team, we're all keeping the list of questions. And then for the month of February, we're going to do 28 questions in 28 days and start to answer them on our LinkedIn and post a video. Now, what was fascinating about it was, firstly, some of the questions, you're right, we were like, oh, didn't realize that was the top question. So there was definitely some eye openers. I think if you tracked it in terms of vanity metrics, you'd go, oh, that wasn't a success. We didn't get X amount of gazillion likes and suddenly became more popular than Paris Hilton. But my definition of success for it was the amount of people who I would jump on a call with and they'd go, hey, Abby, I'm loving your videos at the moment. They hadn't liked them. They hadn't shared them. They hadn't commented. To all intents and purposes, I had no idea they'd even seen it. But people were then commenting how they then found it valuable. So to me, that was the definition of success. I think the secondary thing for us for success is I'll be really honest and say what we struggle with is we are always serving our clients. So sometimes we, you know, come last. And what it forced us into was that amazing momentum on our own LinkedIn, on our own sales and marketing, that every day we had committed to show up and I will be there. And so it also forced and built a really, really, really good new habit by throwing it out there, staking the ground, we're going to do it. So I would absolutely say it was a game changer for us. But as long as you measure it by looking at a more holistic view rather than just a very narrow vanity metric view.
Yeah. And I think you're spot on there. There's so much in what you just said. You know, there's the magic of showing up. First and foremost, the magic of committing to showing up and just how much, in terms of sharpening your own swords, how much better you would have got in the process of answering those questions, how much you would have learned about your own topic, about how to explain it, about what was resonating, what wasn't resonating. I'm assuming that maybe people are asking other questions as well. So you're building your question bank by putting all this, you know, putting it out there. But I wrote an article in my newsletter just this week. On Monday it went out, and part of the article, I said, you know, not much happens in 30 days, usually. Not a lot changes. Occasionally, you know, every once in a while, there might be a conversation that changes the game. There might be a door that opens. There might be a client that suddenly says yes. But usually not much happens in 30 days. But if you can take the bull by the horns and do something different and step up and show up when it's not perfect, when you might not have all the perfect answers yet, if you can do that, then I can guarantee you the chances of something happening in that 30 days, of a door opening, of a client saying yes, of a new conversation that changes everything, is a hell of a lot higher than it would have been if you had not done it.
Mm.
So I think you're right. The magic of showing up, the momentum, the conversations it sparks, your own understanding of your own target market is well worth the effort that it takes to do it.
Absolutely. And I think the other thing for me, and this is my other Julie-ism that is in our office that I wanted to draw back to, the girls I think all live in fear because I come off the phone, I'm like, I've just spoken to Julie Masters, and everyone's like, oh God, what's Abby going to say now? What great idea has she just had? Everyone run and hide.
Yeah, I used to have that in the office. Well, I've been working in the world of ideas for 20 years for a reason, and that is because I love ideas, compelling ideas and compelling people who can bring them to life. And I used to, the girls used to have a saying in the office, it's called the crazy jar. And anytime I spent any time on a plane, because when I had time on a plane, I'd be thinking, I'd be joining the dots on different people that I'd heard and different ideas that I'd come across and like, And I'd come in, and every time I came off a plane, they'd be like, all right, just start talking. And then for the first hour, everything you say is just going in the crazy jar. We'll revisit it later. We don't need any more ideas.
I'm totally editing this part of the interview out so that my team don't hear it. We're not having a crazy jar.
I'm going to buy you a crazy jar.
Oh, no. God, whoever has that jar will be so rich. But what it does bring me to, so coming back on track, because I wanted to talk to you about this piece, is something I think has been a game changer for me that I've learned from you has been the concept of, you talked before several times about people's strategies is out interrupt. If I interrupt you enough, you'll pay attention. And your strategy is more about how can I out contribute, which is what you've been talking to. So can you, and that word, that out contribute, that has really stuck with me again on my Julie checklist. You know, is it a keep it a share it? Am I out contributing? So can you talk to us about that out contribute mentality?
Yeah, I mean, I studied marketing at university. So I spent four years studying and then worked in, you know, various different corporations in London, putting it into practice. And I could pretty much just boil the whole thing down. It's depressing. I could boil, like, you know, 8 to 10 years of my life down into three core strategies. And, you know, one strategy is out interrupt. I'll just interrupt you. Let's just up the interruption factor. Let's interrupt more people more frequently and, you know, digital has given us this beautiful platform for interruptions. It's one of the things that it's brought that, you know, I think has this incredible potential, but the way that we're using it right now is at a very minimal degree and a non-helpful degree. And that is, now we just have more places to interrupt people. We're not thinking any harder about how we want to communicate. We're able to up our interruptions. And, you know, I tell this story about my mum, and, you know, my mum, she's no interest in tech, none at all. She has no, like, not interested in social media. She not interested in email, not interested in tech at all. And I called her, and this is a while ago now, I called her and I was like, you know, how you doing, mum? And she said, oh, you know, I've come across this amazing thing, this amazing new thing. And I was like, what is it? And she's like, oh, it's your dad set it up. What I do is I put on EastEnders and then I pause it and I go and make a cup of tea. And then 5 minutes later, I come back and I press play and then I just fast forward all the ads. It's brilliant. And, you know, it just got me, it really hit me. I was like, oh my God, if my mum, my 70-year-old mum, has figured out how to stop being interrupted. The other strategy, that when I said three strategies, is outspend. If I just spend more than anybody else, then I'll be guaranteed to get attention and engagement and impact. And again, if my mum's figured out how to stop you from interrupting her, how to stop people from outspending to get her attention. And the third one is volume. I'll just outshout everybody else. I'll just get louder. You know, if she's figured out how to avoid all these three strategies in the time it takes to make a cup of tea, then, you know, the future of these strategies appears to be limited unless we can find a smarter way of doing it. And, you know, there's all kinds of innovations in this space right now. And if you want to see the best of the best in this space right now, you know, B2C is where it's at. You know, there's amazing innovations there when it comes to lead nurturing, when it comes to, you know, focusing down on questions, epic storytelling. Also, you know, one of the best places that I'm looking right now is Kickstarter. You know, I'm fascinated with the idea of Kickstarter, the fact that, you know, in a 2-minute video, you can convince me to pledge money for an idea that I didn't know existed. You know, they're on the edges. That's where we're finding the most inspiration at the moment. But to come back to the point is that most of us, to some degree, fall back on these three strategies because it's all we've ever done, it's all we've ever known, it's all we've ever been taught. So out shout, out spend, or out interrupt. And what we need to start looking at now, focusing on exactly the keep it or share it rule, is out contributing. How do I out contribute everybody else in my space? Because the people that you trust, people that you follow, people who you pay attention to, and all influence really is the ability to say, you know, look over there and have somebody be engaged enough to look and hopefully trust you enough to take action. Those people are usually the ones that have out-contributed everybody else in that space for us. And that's when we start focusing on out contributing as opposed to out interrupting.
And I think I've personally found since we've used it, it's a great mindset shift to go, right, if one of our goals is to out contribute everyone, how are we doing that? And it brings you completely centered more towards the customers.
Yeah. And there's also a danger to it. You know, when we talk about out contributing, you know, do I just post a million times? Do I just send a million emails? And I think that that's a really important distinction to talk about, because what out contributing, you're exactly right. It's our mindset. This is, again, not a volume. This is not based on volume. In some situations, volume is should be this. In other situations, it should be this. This is not about frequency. And again, you know, frequency takes you into an interruption mindset. This is a mindset of contribution. This is, you know, my job as a translator is to decode a journey, a very particular journey for the people that I'm trying to serve. And how can I contribute regularly, usefully, purposefully, and, you know, in an engaging way throughout that journey to help people get from A to Z? That's what having a contribution mindset is. Where might they trip? What information might they need? What questions might they have? Who else can I bring in that's on my panel that's going to help them navigate this road? You know, that's the mindset of contribution. It's a very different mindset to a mindset of interruption, which is what we fall back on often when we don't know what else to do. Yeah. So I think you're right. I think that flip in our brain is a really important one to have. Otherwise, we do fall into just interrupting as frequently as we can.
No, I absolutely love it. And I love that you mentioned there with purpose. You know, one of your courses I did at the end, I said, you know, when I was debriefing with the team, so much of it was around like really getting behind that purpose, that intent. It was so intentional. So I want to ask
one of the most powerful questions. What is your intention? What's the one thing you want to, just to speak to intention for a second, what's the one thing you want them to do, feel, believe differently as a result of this piece of communication? That's powerful intent, and that has way more correlation with action than something that has no intention. We call it like spray and pray, baby. Spray as many platforms as you personally can. Get up on the stage, just dump as much information as you can on human beings, and then leg it. You know, it's very different. It's purposeful. It's contribution. It's intention.
So I promised I would let you leave on time. So I have to squeeze one last question in very quickly. You are the one person that, it's so funny, whenever I'm going for a run and I'm like, what podcast should I listen to? Oh, I don't know which ones I want to choose from. I'm always listening to your podcast, because with your podcast, you've always gone out and found these awesome people, half of whom I actually haven't heard of before and probably should have. And they just come in with the latest and the greatest and this amazing stuff. So if you are that translator for me, that you go out onto the fringes, you bring it back and you translate it. So yeah, if you're ever looking for a really great podcast, Julie, if ever I'm undecided, I'm like, let's see what Jules has released. So that brings me to my final question, which is actually, what do you see, given that you are so much on the fringes of what's happening, as coming our way in terms of sales and marketing? What are some of the future things that we should be looking out for?
Oh, so many things. Probably the big one at the moment for me is the future of storytelling. There's some fascinating innovations happening at the moment when it comes to storytelling. You know, there's the chemical makeup of a compelling story. There's people like Paul Zak, that's a podcast episode, who have got a company called Immersion. And what they do, they can now predict with 80% accuracy if they show you a particular story. So they make you wear a Fitbit and they measure your vital signs, which is a symbol of having oxytocin in your system. Oxytocin being the molecule of trust and engagement and the essential molecule of storytelling. They can predict with 80% accuracy whether you will donate to a particular charity or to support a particular cause after watching a video about that cause based on your vital signs, which means that stories these days, or certainly in the future, are going to be designed literally with biology, with measuring our biology. And so, you know, if you're not catching up in the world of storytelling now, you know, wait until, you know, storytelling is measured by your biology, and you're able to, you know, other people are able to create stories that are literally going to guarantee impact. And you're still, you know, trying to create stories that you think might make an impact. So yeah, the edges of storytelling, there's so much I could talk about there, but that's what's really got my attention at the moment.
Julie, thank you so much for coming on. Where can people find you?
Find me website, juliemasters.com, LinkedIn, podcast, Inside Influence, search iTunes. They're probably the primary hangouts, I would say. And the Influencer Code ebook, which you can find on my website, which has the kind of the core components of everything that we've talked about today. Thank you so much for having me on, Han. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in. Now, before you leave us, if you would like to download our latest white paper on the state of sales and marketing, which unpacks 4 steps to drive hyper growth in your business, please visit whitepaper.salesredefined.com.au. And if you enjoyed this episode, please make sure that you subscribe so that you never miss a future episode. And finally, we would absolutely love it and appreciate it if you could leave us a review and maybe even share with a friend. We'll see you next time.